How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Borderlines podcast, a podcast for the discussion of Canadian border, immigration, and refugee issues. I'm Steve Murins. In R.V. Kattenberg, a recent federal court of appeal decision involving the labeling of wine from the West Bank, Justice Stratus stated, quote, "As for judges, some give the impression that they decide cases based on their own personal preferences, politics, and ideologies, whether they be liberal, conservative, or whatever. Increasingly, they wander into the public square and give virtue signaling and populism a go. They write op-eds, deliver speeches, and give interviews, extolling constitutional rights as absolutes that can never be outweighed by pressing public interest concerns and embracing people, groups, and causes that line up with their personal view of what is just, right, and fair. They do these things even though cases are under reserve and other cases are coming to them." End quote. So this paragraph, I thought, raises some interesting philosophical questions that regularly get brought up and which I thought could be an interesting podcast episode to discuss topics such as what is the role of judges, how does the public expect them to behave, and even what is virtue signaling. I'm joined in this episode by Andrew Hayes, a U.S. immigration attorney who practices U.S. immigration law in Vancouver. And he brings a American perspective to the conversation. Andrew and I had a relatively informal, almost philosophical conversation about judges and virtue signaling. And we talked about the case of a Toronto judge who wore a Trump hat to court, a Quebec judge who called herself a feminist before commenting on an active case before her, and comments by the late Ruth Justice Ruth Bader Gingrich. Sorry, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, about Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign. So it's not too, it's not a very substantive law podcast, and this episode isn't immigration focused, but it is a interesting, I think, philosophical discussion around an interesting topic. If you'd like to leave a review of the podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, please do. You can also email me any comments, facts, checks, etc. at stevenmurins@larly.com. That's steven.murins@larly.com. larlee.com. I hope you enjoy.
wonder if we could sort of wax philosophical for just a little bit as to, just generally speaking, not maybe in particular legal systems, but what is the role of the judiciary? And thinking about this, I admit that I pulled up good old Wikipedia and looked into the history. And certainly it goes back, the role of the judiciary goes back really to the mists of time. And in thinking about this, I sort of considered it as something that is apart from a society, certainly apart from somewhat from the political aspects of society, whatever the lawmaking function is, if that was, in parliamentary system or legislature, the judiciary role was separate from that. And I would say that in the early days, you often had combined roles where you had the absolute monarch, where you had separate roles. You had the executive, symbolized by perhaps the sword. You had the rulemaking component, right? The state, it is me. And then the decider, the actual judiciary aspects as well. So those then were both contained, but also separate functions within the monarch, shall we say, that were then slowly split off by, we'll call them reformers. Yeah. But that'd be, Magna Carta sort of era where the nobles were asserting their privilege to be separate from the monarch, including certain judiciary reforms. Speedy trial, I believe, was one of those. But I sort of see, my sort of view of it is that the judicial branches are apart from, or at least ideally apart from, the political side of the functioning of government, ultimately to render judgments, decisions on controversy. So whether they be a tort where two parties are arguing over possession or loss or something like that, a decision has to be rendered. And I would say that the societal benefit from rendering decision is avoiding turmoil, specifically violence. Without a neutral arbiter, eventually violence will take over. Someone will, go down with their uncles and cousins and take the cow back by violence.
When you say neutral, you mean that is someone, like, obviously they are human. So is it just that the presumption that you're appearing before someone who, at least when they look at the decision, has a complete blank slate? And going back to Amy Coney Barrett, the statements that a Catholic shouldn't make, I think she wrote at one point that a Catholic shouldn't make decisions in death penalty cases because they couldn't uphold the law first over their faith. So is it neutral in that you do want that blank slate? You're appearing before a blank slate.
Well, I think that there's of course the ideal, and then there is the reality. I would imagine that human beings throughout time have understood judges to be human beings and have their own feelings, whether that be moral feelings or religious feelings or what have you. But I would say that the function is to be as neutral as possible so that a final decision can be rendered. And that's certainly true both in the political sphere, whether that be ascertaining whether laws are constitutional in the American context or not in violation of the charter or should be withheld or withstood. The biggest concern, historically, is to have the ability to actually render judgment, I would say. So there's almost a transactional nature to it. And I think maybe the word transactional has been polluted somewhat, but it's to come up with an answer. And certainly on the admin side of things, the judges have to render decisions.
Yeah.
And they are assigned almost quotas in the immigration system, which is there's a burden on the judges. They need decisions, but at the same time, they are...
So when you say quotas, are you talking about a number of decisions or an approval rate?
A number of decisions.
Yeah, just wanted to make, like, just to make... Yeah.
Yes, that's not
talking that the U.S. judges have.
Sorry, yes, so that should be clear. It's not a certain way, but there is the transactional notion, which is coming to decisions. But too many decisions too quickly is rubber stamping, right? It's not actual justice. This sort of ideal notion of something that is fair and neutral and, I guess, just.
Yeah, for me, the ideal notion, well, I think most of my clients have what they consider to be the ideal notion, which is whenever we do a judicial review, I would say most of my clients start from the presumption of, okay, the level of bias and inexperience will start, at least from the client's perspective, at the most with the Immigration, Refugee and Citizenship Canada officer, the CBSA officer, the bureaucrat essentially making the decision. Rightly or wrongly, the client will think, okay, well, this person might have bias, who knows what they're training. And then the client will then say, okay, well, now we're at the Immigration Appeal Division. This must be someone who I'm appearing before who has a lot more experience than the people who made the frontline decisions, which isn't the way it works. Like, a lot of my clients think that the people at the Immigration Refugee Board are just, say, a CBSA officer or an IRCC officer who's been there 30 or 40 years, which isn't the way it works. But that's the perception that you're now appearing before a quasi-judicial board, that this is one step up. And then the federal court, well, now we're appearing before, as far as the client's perception is, a judge is going to decide on whether a decision was reasonable or unreasonable. And this judge will be a neutral arbiter who is the wisest of the wise. In fact, it often stuns my clients when I have to say that judges actually don't know the intricacies of how an immigration program works. They understand how the reasonableness concept works and can flesh out a decision. And the clients, to the extent that I've shown them some of, and we did a previous podcast episode with Sean Rehag, that yes, it actually does matter greatly who the federal court judge is, but there still is the ideal is that perception. Like, and in an ideal world, I don't think, I mean, there wouldn't be these big variances in who the decision maker is. I guess, as you say, like, what the importance would be having this neutral arbiter or decision maker. Does any perception, does the whole system depend on people believing that these judges essentially are able to be completely neutral? And does that depend on judges not speaking essentially outside of the courtroom?
Well, I think that we're having a very interesting conversation in the United States right now. It's mostly referred to about under the title of court packing. And so if I may just talk a little bit about that, the term I believe comes from the Roosevelt era. So at in that era, the Supreme Court struck down a number of ambitious public works programs. Basically, they deemed that it was an improper delegation of the legislative lawmaking function away from Congress over to agencies. There was more or less a threat made by Roosevelt to say, get in line with my viewpoints on this, or I'll just keep adding judges until it goes my way. This was not well received at the time. This was even by I guess partisans.
Yeah.
Ultimately, one of the judges or justices changed their mind on delegation, and modern agency and admin law was born from that. But absolutely, there is this notion that if justices can be compromised, then it is permissible for Congress to exert its natural power to stack the court. And it's sort of often talked about as if it's somehow illegal or unconstitutional, which it is absolutely not, because Article 3 gives the power to staff the judiciary or frame the judiciary to Congress. So it's always an inherent power of Congress to change the way that looks. I think Congress should be careful doing that personally, because it invites a political intrusion into the judiciary that is hard to unwind. Obviously, one side adds some judges, so will the other side in an endless cycle, potentially. And that reduces the power of the judiciary in doing so. And I would say, at least in the Supreme Court context, there's a jealous guard of its power, really starting from the Marbury case. And the Marbury case was the 1803 decision, in which I think it was Justice Marshall. Let me make sure I get that right. They basically created the concept of judicial review. It was created from a view of the spaces in between the articles of the Constitution. Now, one could argue this was taking implied rights from the enumerated rights, or at least enumerated process. But it really is the foundation of the federal judiciary's power, which is to decide what the law is. And I've got a quote right here. It is emphatically...
This is from Marbury and Madison?
Marbury versus Madison. It is emphatically the province and the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. So, sort of strategically here, the Supreme Court struck down a law that gave the court jurisdiction over an issue, saying that that's a political issue. We don't have jurisdiction over political issues. That resides in the political branches of government. So, no, we don't have jurisdiction. But at the same time, we absolutely do have the right to say what the law is, thus appointing themselves as that arbiter.
Yeah.
So these things are intermingled, is what I'm saying. But the judiciary has power based on its ability to resist political intrusions. Although inherently, the political branches can overwhelm the judiciary if they decide to do so.
Yeah, was it Andrew Jackson? I can't remember the name of the judge, but they have rendered their decision. I'd like to see them enforce it.
Yes, you and what army? That's exactly it.
Where does it right now? I think pub polls show that, at least in Canada, I think it's the same in the States, that the public still overwhelmingly trusts the judiciary. An obvious risk of overt bias showing would be people lose their confidence. From a practical standpoint, how would that actually manifest itself beyond? Would it just be that, you know, we start using the term kangaroo courts in like either Canada or the US, or because they still have the even if people lose faith in the judiciary,
well, the decisions are still rendered. And enforced.
Yeah.
So presumably the executive branch would still enforce the decisions there. So I don't really think it would be an immediate catastrophe. I think that at least in terms of the Supreme Court, it does introduce some issues in terms of sort of the orderliness of the administration of the country.
Yeah. One of the things we have in Canada that I don't believe exists in the United States is the notwithstanding clause. So Section 33 of our charter provides that Parliament can essentially overrule the Supreme Court. So if the Supreme Court says that something is a breach of, not on all aspects of the charter, but some of the major ones, freedom of expression, the right to freedom from discrimination, the right to not be searched without reason. For any breach that is found, the parliament or a legislature can say, okay, can just pass a law essentially that says, notwithstanding what the courts have said, we're going to do it anyway. I think it has to, I think there's a time limit on it and it has to be renewed. It was most recently, I don't remember if he just threatened to use it or if he actually used it, but in Toronto or in Ontario, the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, I think right before an election in Toronto, went in and basically changed the composition of Toronto City Council, disqualifying in effect some candidates who were going to run. And a Ontario Superior Court judge said, this is unconstitutional. And the Premier Ford came out and said, and I'm pretty sure he invoked it, that notwithstanding that judgment, this is how it's going to be. The Ontario, and there were accusations flying both ways, that the judge was biased against Doug Ford. Doug Ford, obviously, as the politician, had his own biases, but and the Ontario Court of Appeal ultimately allowed the appeal of the lower court judge's decision. So that decision was quashed ultimately, and the notwithstanding clause didn't have to be used. But it provides, at least in Canada, this outlet. But it does provide, I think, a bit of like a safeguard from at least this extreme, I guess, almost drive to politicize the judiciary, because it's seen as this final arbiter of last resort whose judgments can't be set aside. In Canada, I think one of the reasons that it's become less politicized than in the United States is because there are other outlets that people who want to exert that political influence can take. So they don't have to necessarily say, we need this person to pack the courts. Look, if we just elect, if we can drive at the political level, we could, in theory, just elect a premier or a prime minister who will just ignore the courts.
So the United States does not have a notwithstanding clause equivalent. Although when you were discussing this, it brought to mind the nullification crisis. It's a related concept where this was as a sort of a prelude to the American Civil War, when there was a question between the power allocations of the states and the federal government. And this, what I believe, was a trade dispute, tariff dispute between South Carolina and the federal government, where South Carolina more or less said, yeah, those tariffs are unconstitutional, and we're just not going to do that. We're going to be our own decider, regardless of what you guys are doing. And of course, these conflicts between the allocations of power eventually culminated in the Civil War. It was obviously a very complicated mixture of issues.
Slavery there. As well.
Yes, slavery was of course mixed in with that. But the issues of allocations of power between the states and the federal government really is as old as the formation of the country, and the first constitution being the Articles of Confederation, as opposed to the actual constitution we have today.
So I think
that the fundamental questions are always the same. There's a general question of what is justice, what is the purpose of the judiciary, and then there's the more narrow question of what is the judge's role in a particular transaction. And sometimes it's more expansive. For example, the Supreme Court. Those are often, these more expansive issues, right? What is a right? What is a constitutional protection? These sorts of things. And then there are more narrow questions, which is, for example, how should we label this bottle of wine? We also have these other sort of transnational concepts of justice. In the realm of international law. And one question I sort of had for you was, what is the role of an intervener, just generally? I wonder if it's similar to amicus curiae, which is a friend of the court. Basically,
we use the exact same term.
So it's essentially the same, yeah. The same thing?
Same idea.
So amicus briefs are there to be helpful and relevant for let's say, the judge to understand the situation and the impacts of the decision. And these sorts of aspects can actually get drawn into the international realm. So I admit I didn't read the entire decision, but I imagine that some of those interveners have an interest in looking at the application of such questions as what is an occupation, what is legitimate exercise of power, et cetera, et cetera. Looking at local courts here in Canada and applying that potentially in an international context. There's a couple of ICJ cases that are relevant there. Certainly the Wall was one of those.
Yeah.
And so in international law, customary international law, which is the laws of local nations, I call states local, state law, and looking for patterns within that to ascertain what is custom throughout the world. And that is persuasive in international courts, such as the ICJ.
Yeah. It's similar, I think, in Canada as it is the United States, which is just amicus curiae offer an opinion to the court on an area of, usually it's an organization and their expertise as to just some aspect of the decision that they can highlight, whether it's a privacy concern, say, in unreasonable search and seizure, or in, say, the immigration context, you'll often see the Canadian Association of Refugee Lawyers intervene because they will often have a perspective to bring forward that is broader than an individual case or lawyer who is appearing before the Supreme Court might bring, and they'll want to intervene. So it's pretty similar, I think, to what you see in the United States.
Hmm. So it seems to me that there's sort of dual pressures on judges, depending on the context. One is that they have this sort of transactional concept, which is that they have to render a judgment on whatever the particular issue is. At the same time, they have a duty to appear to be just. And now, all of a sudden, we're into a philosophical realm, and the context matters. So on a momentous decision, let's say, Brown versus the Board, one of the most important decisions out of the U.S. Supreme Court, it deserved some comment outside of the very narrow issue of whether the particular segregation in a particular area of Kansas was constitutional or not. And of course, that decision overturned a prior decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, and the court stated that it had gotten the first decision incorrect.
Brown v. Board, I mean, assuming most listeners will know what it is, but that's basically desegregating schools in the United States.
Yes, it opened up this concept of what equal protection is from the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, along with the other amendments outlawing slavery, were the post-Civil War amendments, and they were framed quite generally. Well, some of them were framed quite generally, like equal protection. Well, what does that mean, of course, is the next question. And Plessy versus Ferguson, the predecessor decision, said something could be both separate and equal and not violate equal protection. Whereas Brown came along and said, no, certain forms of separation, specifically segregation, can never be equal.
Is Ferguson, this is totally off, but like topic, is Ferguson the name of the school or the city? Or like Plessy, I assume, was the individual in that case. Who is Ferguson?
I regret to say I don't know off the top of my head. As I recall, Plessy versus Ferguson was I guess one of these impact violation or impact legislation. Sorry, impact.
It's the separate cases. But equal decision.
Yes, okay. But I believe it was an individual who sort of as part to create the controversy which they litigate. Went to a place on it was either a carriage or train that was a segregated area. Yeah. So they went to the whites only section and sat down and had to be removed. And I believe it was that. So I don't know if Ferguson was the commissioner or something like that. But
city of Missouri. Anyway, yeah, but sorry, I threw you off there.
Oh yeah, well I guess what I was saying is that there is an inherent political aspect to two judges' role in that they must appear to be just.
Yeah.
If they fail to appear to be just, then the political realm, you know, I guess in the United States case, you know, the elected officials will reform the judiciary because they are the most responsible. Well, the political parts of the government are most responsive to the people, and so if Congress thinks they can push the judiciary around and not have a problem, well, then they probably will.
Yeah.
And the system.
And do you think all that is keeping that from happening is the perception that the judiciary is just?
A very large. Yeah. I mean, everyone knows it's probably a dangerous thing to mess with. but yes, I think that is their perception of being just. And again, we're talking very generally here, is extremely important for their survival.
Yeah.
And so what I guess I'm saying is that they're always playing somewhat of a political game. And that's why I think that in particular circumstances, judges feel it's necessary to discuss their line of reasoning and what their perceptions of justice is outside of narrowly deciding a decision. And I think the context matters.
Yeah. So I have three examples that I pulled up in a quick search of judges' virtue signaling. Curious, we could have a quick discussion on each one regarding whether you think it crosses a line, whether you think it impacts whether that person will be seen as being just. So the first
one. So you're putting me on the record so that when I'm nominated to the Supreme Court, this will come up in the hearing, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. What were you part of some church that called its people handmaids? Or what did you say on from CBC News. In 2017, a Canadian judge wore a Trump hat in court, and he was suspended for 30 days, burned Zabel in Ontario, suspended without pay for wearing a Make America Great Again hat in court. He said he was simply trying to make people laugh.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
And, you know, let's assume that, let's take away the, like, the, just the appearance, ignoring the fact that I guess he thought people who were appearing before him would have a chuckle about it. What, and I don't think it says what kind of judge he was, but in terms of a judge wearing a hat, Duff Conacher of Democracy Watch says if he had worn a Justin Trudeau hat, the reaction would have been just as strong. And I guess Make America Great Again is certainly, you know, a political, it's basically a partisan political statement. So let's summarize Make America Great Again as, like, what are your thoughts on, do you think a judge wearing a political hat in court?
Well, it was probably a bad idea. I would say, I guess, context matters here. And this is not, Trump doesn't represent anyone here in Canada. It's, I mean, he is a foreign political figure. And so in that sense, I would say a Justin Trudeau hat, as the example you gave, would be more inappropriate because, well, he's part of the political sphere, whereas Trump really is not. Trump has no say on internal Canadian affairs, at least.
Yeah, it would depend, I think, in part on the context of the Make America Great Again in an immigration court. You'd be like, okay.
Well, I think that would be...
Then there's a more direct link between the hat and the subject matter.
I think it's distracting, and it would be unhelpful, I would say, as something. It's unhelpful to the administration of justice as it is distracting to it. Make America Great Again, certainly. And I think in that article, people said, "Well, that's representative of racism and bad forms of nationalism, etc." It just seems a distraction from the administration of justice, and therefore probably should be avoided. But judges are people too.
In the states where they do run, like, when a judge runs, are they running as a Republican or a Democrat?
Yes. Yes.
Would this be a thing? Would judges wear their party's hats in the courtroom?
So this would be on the state side. So it would be the judicial code of conduct for the state. I can't speak for other states, but in the state of Washington, the appearance of impropriety is would be a violation. So I would imagine that that judges would seek not to show political favor in the courtroom for that very reason.
Yeah. Case number two, Nicole Duval Hessler, December 2019, Quebec Chief Justice criticized for declaring herself feminist at Bill 21 hearing. And first from the article, Quebec's Chief Justice declared herself a feminist in court last week and then suggested opposition to the province's secularism law resulted from, quote, visual allergies, end quote, to seeing women in a hijab. I actually think that's a bit separate from she tied the feminism to the visual allergies comment together. So I guess it's related, but let's say a judge declaring herself to be a feminist in court. Interestingly enough, when I first read that she had declared herself to be a feminist in the context of that case, it wasn't fully clear to me, at least immediately without reading on, whether that meant that she supported Bill C-21 or was against it. Bill C-21 is the law in Quebec that bans essentially a lot of visible religious gear, religious attire in Quebec, including and prohibits people from, I think, giving a public service and receiving a public service, with the main one being if they're wearing a veil. When the Quebec judge said that she was a feminist, I initially wasn't sure if she meant, well, I support women being able to wear what they want, so I support Bill C, or I'm against Bill C-21, or I think the veil is a symbol of women oppression, so I'm against Bill C-20, or I'm for Bill C-21. But in any event, a judge declaring, I guess, outright, I am this, therefore my decision will be this.
Well, I think it goes back to this notion of what is helpful and what is not helpful in the administration of justice. And I would say that, generally speaking, sort of logical fallacies based on appeals to either authority or oneself are not particularly helpful. Because law is not the individual, it is above the individual. It's not rule by law, it's rule of law. And I think, you know, speaking about a historical conversation, that really was the big transition, is that there is this thing that is above everybody, yeah, at least theoretically, as opposed to ruling by law, yet I am the sovereign, I am immune. We still have some vestiges there, I suppose. I'm immune, and I will use law to rule my subjects, or whatever. So I don't know exactly the context here, but I would wonder how helpful it is for a judge to announce their personal beliefs as a justification for a decision, as it's really immaterial.
Yep. Well, and that gets to, and it really does kill me that I keep having to use U.S. examples, but there was the judge that President Trump wanted recused from hearing, I think, one of the travel bans or the wall case because the person was Mexican.
Yes. Now, this example, I think, was very interesting because Trump's argument, it was Curio, I think, was the judge's name. The judge was not, quote, Mexican. The judge was born in the United States.
Oh, right. I remember that.
And either Mexican or Hispanic descent. It was a descent. So the notion that Trump put forward there was truly a racist notion, that because this individual was descended from Hispanic origins, that he necessarily couldn't be impartial to the question in front of him. And so I would say that this clearly meets every definition of racist comment. That was, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because at the same time that we're saying this, there's also, like, you want diversity on the bench because you get a diverse background or experiences that people have, but you don't necessarily want them, you don't want it to be explicit or even implicit because I am X characteristic, I rule as Y.
And since since I'm on the record here, I don't want to misquote, but I'll just do my best here. Justice Sotomayor, another Supreme Court justice, was criticized for saying something along the lines of, it's time for there to be a wise Latina on the court. Paraphrasing, it was something along those lines. And she was criticized for this. And I don't exactly remember the context, but it mixed this kind of idea, is that, yes, and on one hand, we want to have a diversity of backgrounds and individuals on the court. So again, I'm talking Supreme Court here.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, we also don't really want to, we want to pretend that's not the case.
Yeah.
So it's this duality that sort of stalks the judiciary. And it's, there was the, quote, Jewish seat on the court. There's the black seat on the court. These concepts exist. Should they exist? I think that there's a lot of room for debate about that. But it's this duality. On one hand, it's widely talked about and acknowledged. On the other hand, we want to pretend, no, there is no, there's no interest group seat at the table.
Well, and moving to another liberal member of the Supreme Court and comment she made, Ginsburg criticizes Trump. So this is from July. This is the Washington Post's view. So it was an editorial by the Washington Post in which Justice Ginsburg, I'm trying to find her exact comments, but Justice Ginsburg had made anti-Trump remarks to the New York Times, and she told CNN that week that Trump has no consistency about him. He says whatever comes into his head at the moment. He really has an ego. And I think that was the extent of her comments, and it was criticized, and she wound up having to apologize for it. So judge of any level explicitly criticizing the judiciary, judge of any level explicitly criticizing the executive or a member of the executive. I think at that time he was still a candidate. Does that cast doubt on their ability to rule fairly on them in future cases?
I think it has a potential for that, certainly. Does it absolutely? I don't think so. And I think that, again, comes back to this notion that judges and justices are human beings that do have opinions. Yeah. They do have religious morals and beliefs. They do have political beliefs as well. I would say, again, it was not helpful for Justice Ginsburg to do that. And I believe she apologized.
Yeah, she apologized, I think, quite forcefully.
And so I think that, generally speaking, we do realize that part of the role of the judge is to, as best they can, when they're ruling on a decision, put aside those personal feelings and focus on the issue at hand.
Yeah.
And focus on the issue at hand. So I think it is somewhat fluid there, and context dictates. And I did have to look up the Sotomayor comment. It was actually from a speech in 2001. So it was not.
So that's well before she was going to get.
It was well before, yes. But it was, I believe, brought up in the confirmation process.
Yeah, I think there's I'm not sure how much you can fault someone before they ever, or maybe she was a judge then, but not on the Supreme Court. But I do think, and from what I've seen in chatting with judges, and certainly lawyers who I know who serve on different arbitration committees or adjudicative committees, they're really good at putting their personal biases aside and having to decide a case on its merits before them. And at least the people I know who have been in those roles have been very careful about what they say in regards to that topic at all. In Canada, there's been an issue raised lately in terms of the appropriate roles of judges after they retire, in terms of becoming litigators. Former Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin was been hired by different provinces. There was unfortunate during a recent political scandal involving former Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould that I can't remember who it was said, oh, we can just hire Bev to get the opinion that we want, so don't worry, you're not breaking the law, because I think they, in terms of whether to grant SNC-Lavalin, a Quebec construction or Quebec massive infrastructure company, a contract, and she was saying, I think this is unconstitutional. Someone in the Prime Minister's office said, don't worry, we'll just get Bev McLaughlin to give us the opinion we want. And it led to a little bit of grumbling about whether or not she had become partisan. which I think also wasn't helpful because I think she wrote a, she either gave a speech or she wrote a book where she had criticisms of former Prime Minister Harper. So do you think, like, how long should a judge be constrained in terms of what they can and can't do to continue to give the, so that people don't look back and say, well, when she, now we know that when she was a judge, she was biased.
I see. Well, I think it's really up to the judge. And I guess this is not my, my own personal opinion, which I will just throw out there for the heck of it. It's really the act of judges that it's role playing. It's a role that has to be played because, as you point out, we well know that people have their individual biases. How well can they set that aside to administer justice? So I would say that if you're an individual judge and you then, you know, go into the public sphere afterwards and it casts doubt on your on your prior jurisprudence, it's your choice, I suppose. I don't think judges should be limited at all. I think it's a judgment call. And if it does cast doubt, well, it's casting doubt on their jurisprudence. And I presume that the advocates will be out there ready to
to exploit that. Bias accusation. Well, and it's interesting also just like, I don't know, it seems like Peter, when he became a judge, has not issued a tweet, has, I don't know if he was on anything else before, but it is interesting that a reasonable expectation that judges will refrain from social media. I'm pretty sure they have to put all their investments into blind trusts in Canada or have some third party manage them, so they're not seen to be involved there. But like, you know, the guy with the Trump hat, what if he had worn it outside the court? And in today's age, someone, you know, took a picture of him, or Borat, you know, films him with his hands down his pants. Like Giuliani, like, how much do we expect, like, outside of the courtroom? Judges, like, is it realistic to expect that judges completely censor themselves to maintain this impression of neutrality?
Yes, well, I think that again it comes down to the context. So in the actual courtroom, it's I guess one could call it a quasi secular sacred space. It's where justice is done, and of course judges have rights just like everybody else, including the right to speech. I think it's a judgment call and one that's framed by the expectations of the community. I don't hang out with lots of judges, so I wouldn't really know. But I imagine that there's a community expectation of decorum and how one speaks about their opinions in a way not to cast cast doubt on judges specifically or generally. And I that's almost a political thing. I mean, it's like politics, you know, it's the action of people. Do we dare at the end of this podcast to try to define what virtue signaling is?
So I think when I think virtue signaling, I looked it up, but I only looked up the origin. It's like a term that was invented by The Spectator in the United Kingdom in either 2004 or 2014. It ends in a four. When I hear virtue signaling, I almost tie it in with, like, I view it. It's funny, like it's a liberal left. I view it as a liberal left. Like when someone says a phrase that shows that they're woke, that's what I think of virtue signaling. If someone were to be like, you know, go QAnon, I wouldn't think like, oh, he's virtue signaling.
It does seem to be an accusation leveled particularly against the left. And it seems to me that there's an implicit speciousness to virtue signaling. It's like it's not the actual virtue itself. It's the signal so that I said the right shibboleth or code or whatever, therefore I'm virtuous. It's like fatuous there. And in terms of the actual decision here, if we define it somewhere along those lines, yes, virtue signaling is not helpful to the administration of justice because it's not really that relevant. It's a be virtuous, be judicious. Don't just appear to be. And appear to be in a transparent way. The appearance of justice must actually be related to the actual administration of it and in its variety of contexts. Well, for example, I mean, these immigration cases, I mean, the judges are not writing decisions in many cases. It's boxes being ticked.
No,
because that's the function that they have to fulfill.
Like all those examples, and this is why I wish that Justice Stratus had like specified what he was referring to, because even Ginsburg's comments about Trump were substantive. It wasn't throwaway. Like to me, virtue signaling would be, and you watch Bill Maher and someone will like make a point for about 3 minutes that's well-reasoned, argued, and the other person will say, I can't even think of an example just on the spur of the moment, but some empty platitude designed to get the audience to just clap, which I guess was really like the spacious, like, you know, where it's like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And none of the, even saying I am a feminist, therefore X, I wouldn't say is virtue signaling as much as, like an example of virtue signaling to me would be if somebody were to level significant criticism of, say, I don't know, the number of deportations in a year, and another person was to respond with, well, we got to remember no one is illegal. And without getting into like an actual substantive thing, but the no one is illegal and gets a lot of like applause, that is what I tend to think of virtue signaling. And it's not something, it's almost separate from a judge showing bias, because like a judge giving a well-reasoned, and I'm just like totally just, a judge giving a well-reasoned description of why they think about something on a certain topic, to me is less concerning than a judge who would say march down the street with a sign that just says like, you know, no justice, no peace or something like that, where like there's still that, because it's well reasoned, because it's articulated, there's the, what's the banality of it, like the, okay, yeah, they're showing their cards, but they're doing so in a reasoned way, and so you can assume that they'll approach reason the same way, where it's little sloganeering that you see is more like, that would be what I would think of virtue signaling.
Well, yeah, and I think it's underlining sort of, you know, what we've been talking about here is well, what is the court there to do? And there, it starts with a big mess always, right? There's a big mess. It has to be narrowed down to specific issues. Fact has to be ascertained in one way or another. Procedure has to be followed. Fact has to be applied to law in its variety of ways. And the transaction is complete. So I would believe that the argument here is to say, don't get distracted by all of that. That the proper realm for that is the political realm, the public forum, et cetera. Keep that over there. Keep it as a narrowing process in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And I would say that at least in the general sense is really the function of the judiciary is to narrowly resolve controversy.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be British here. Is to resolve the controversies so that the society can roll on.
Yeah. Like, anyway, I think that's all I've got as I look outside. It's getting dark and I've got a bike home.
Oh, I've been told I don't do this properly as a podcaster should. Andrew, where can people find you?
They can find me right here at Miller and Hayes.
Is there, you're not on Twitter, right?
No.
What's your email?
My email is andrewh@usborderlaw.com.
Andrew H, one word?
All one word.
Awesome.
Yeah. No social media for me. That's a personal choice.
No virtue signaling, then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.